Breaking news, and this one is almost unbelievable.
Yeah, it's all about new customers at Bet365, because they get $150 in bonus bets when they bet $5, win or lose. And even better, bonus bets can be used on the spread, totals, and player props.
There you have it. Bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. And see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. T&Cs apply. Available in app only.
You're listening to the Common Fan Podcast, a Husker football podcast for the common fan by the common fan.
Welcome back to the Common Fan Podcast. I am TJ Burkle, as always, with Matty Owens Sr. and Geoff in Lincoln. Hey, get to the Common Fan website, www.commonfan.co. Sign up for the newsletter, subscribe on YouTube, follow the social media accounts, and generally keep up with all the fun and frivolity of the Common Fans. As one of our guests today will be able to tell you, you don't start doing push-ups and running sprints when football season starts. You do that before the season, right? So get signed up for the Common Fan website. Start getting your mind right. Start getting ready for the 2025 season. www.commonfan.co. You also want to get your Common Fan socks before the season starts. Go to silliesco.com, S-I-L-L-I-E-S-C-O.com. Use the promo code GBR for life. That's GBR number 4 L-I-F-E. To get 25% off any sock on the site, not just the Common Fan socks, but any socks on the site. Go to silliesco.com to check out all the fun socks they have there. This is episode 4 of TO, a series focused on the coaching career of Tom Osborne. In the first 3 episodes, we looked at Coach Osborne's time as an assistant under Bob Devaney, including his fateful promotion to offensive coordinator in 1968. His early days as a head coach in the 1970s, and his excellent teams of the 1980s, that came painfully close to winning multiple national championships. Make sure to check out those episodes if you haven't already. For today's episode, Reaching the Mountaintop, we'll examine T.O.'s teams of the early 1990s, up to and including his first national championship team in 1994. We're joined today by 2 fantastic guests. Abdul Muhammad played at Nebraska from 1991 through 1994. He was a major contributor over 4 seasons, an All-Big 8 performer, and a critical piece of Tom Osborne's first national title team. Friend of the program, Mitch Sherman, is also joining us. Mitch writes for The Athletic, hosts the Locked On Nebraska podcast, and is one of the best in the business all around when it comes to Nebraska football coverage. Gentlemen, thanks so much to both of you for joining the Common Fans today.
Appreciate y'all having me.
Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. We're going to jump right in here, fellas. So in the prior episode, we talked about Nebraska doing a lot of winning in the 1980s. But by the end of the decade, there were some cracks in the foundation. Coach Osborne's teams were still winning 9 or 10 games a year, but a pattern was emerging of losing to faster, more athletic Florida schools in bowl games, and a few times during the regular season as well. Toward the end of the 1990 season, the Huskers are undefeated and ranked 2nd in the country. They go into the 4th quarter against Colorado up 12-0 and completely fall apart, losing 27-12. Then they give up 45 points in a loss to unranked Oklahoma, and they follow that up by giving up another 45 points to Georgia Tech in a bowl game loss. Now, Colorado and Georgia Tech were the co-national champions that year, so that explains a little bit. But still, the Huskers finished the season ranked 24th, their lowest since 1968. They finish outside the top 10 for the 4th consecutive season. The natives are restless. Now, this is fascinating. From Henry Cordes' outstanding book, Unbeatable, Tom Osborne and the Greatest Era of Nebraska Football, which is a must-have, by the way, for all Big Red fanatics. After that 1990 season, T.O. gathers the staff for a meeting in the South Stadium. He's not panicked, but morale in the program is low. Ultimately, there were several things that resulted from this meeting. The creation of the Unity Council, the hiring of the team's first nutritionist. Perhaps none was more important than the decision to get faster on defense. Defensive backs would be turned into linebackers. Linebackers would become defensive ends. Eventually, the 5-2 would give way to the 4-3. Instead of turning offensive reserves into defenders, the Huskers would specifically recruit speed for the defense. A program somewhat in turmoil, a program searching for answers. Abdul, you were part of the 1991 recruiting class. Can you share with us what your perception of the program was as you were being recruited, and then what the vibe was like in the program once you arrived?
I tell you, when I was being recruited, Nebraska was still one of the most relevant college football teams in the country. Even though that 1990 year ended the way it did, Nebraska was always, they came into every year. I remember growing up being a big-time Husker fan in the top five. It seemed like every year the Huskers came into the season the top five. A lot of times didn't end up doing well because of the bowl game. But that year it was like three consecutive games in a row. And so the recruiting class, you know, when I came in with guys like Dwayne Harris, Cluster Johnson, Christian Peters, Baron Miles, you know, a lot of guys that contributed into winning those championships. A lot of no-nonsense guys, tough guys, but also we had some speed going on in there. And a lot of what people don't know is it wasn't just, you know, DBs turning into linebackers. There were also some all-state running backs turning into linebackers, you know, during that time. There was like three 1,000-yard rushers who played linebacker, you know, during the championship years. You know, they were all state at their high schools, you know. And so that was a big thing, too, that turning some offensive guys to defensive guys.
Love that.
Mitch, anything to add to that? No, I was just going to say, Mitch, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I look at that class, and to speak to exactly what Abdul is saying, a guy I see on there is Tony Veland, and a standout quarterback at Omaha Benson, and he came in and they looked at him at quarterback, and he played some quarterback early in his career at Nebraska, but of course in the class after him, in the 1992 class, he had Tommy Frazier. And Brooke Behringer was a quarterback in that 91 class. So that's kind of the future of your quarterback position right now, or right there. So instead of having Tony Veland, which maybe in the 80s, if this situation were the same and you recruit a great quarterback in 91 and a great quarterback in 92, and maybe you keep Veland as your number three quarterback, or maybe he plays wide receiver or something to that, a wing back, something to that effect, which was Abdul's position. But In the early 90s, you know, Charlie McBride, he wins out in that battle. And so you take a great athlete and you turn him into a defensive player, and he becomes a staple in that secondary that goes on to win a championship in 94. And there are other stories, you know, like that too. It's not like Tony was the only guy from the 91, 92, even probably the 1990 recruiting class of players that where they began to seek athleticism on defense because it was necessary in order to execute that scheme.
Yeah. Mike Manor.
For sure.
Jamil Williams. All those guys were big time running backs. Troy Dumas out of Wyoming, my class. He's a big time running back that got converted to defense in college.
This is like red meat. This is like red meat for me, guys. Like this is, we are getting into the decade. Like we were, you know, 8, 9, 10, 11 years old with these years that we're going to talk about here today. So this is like the beginning of our fandom. So you're naming off all these guys.
I was older than that. I was not 8 years old in 1991, but thank you for bringing that up.
Well, that's
I don't want to date anyone here.
You know, so those years probably attracted you to the Big Red.
Exactly.
The years of the 80 to 83 were the years that attracted me to the Big Red out of California.
Yep. So, Abdul, speaking of that and getting recruited to Nebraska, you mentioned running backs there, and you being an athletic receiver, I'm kind of curious, did you have any reservations about going to a place like Nebraska that was primarily known for running the ball so much? Or how did Coach T.O. sell you on coming here? I'm curious. I like that.
He didn't have to. I was just, that was my dream. I started falling in love with the Big Red at like 9-ish, turning 10. And that was about 83, right? So that's the scoring explosion. 70 points a game. ESPN had just started showing college football games. So I was able to watch games. And then we had prime ticket in California with the big Californians from Nebraska. They used to replay on prime ticket on Sundays, Husker games. So I always got to watch Husker games growing up. And it was just always, I was just always in amazement of how they carried themselves and how they played football. And so that's what got me. I don't know Coach Osborne. I know he came to Compton to recruit me, but I don't remember anything fascinating that really just like, yeah, I was already a Husker fan. Everybody was just in awe that
nice.
He was at my home, you know, as the head coach in Nebraska. Because what's crazy is half of my area I lived in, and all the sports guys, half were Oklahoma, half were Nebraska. Like, we didn't have USC fans, UCLA fans.
Yeah.
It was Oklahoma, Nebraska, you know?
That's so, amazing.
Yeah, which was crazy, right?
Yeah, no kidding.
That is crazy. Well, going back to some of the changes that TJ mentioned that coach decided that needed to be made. Mitch, my recollection is that these changes that coach implemented were talked about and celebrated after Nebraska started winning national titles. But in the moment, in those early 90s, do you remember if this was widely discussed, all these things like the Unity Council and nutrition and getting faster? Were these things like actively being talked about publicly, or is this something that was more kind of a, you know, behind the scenes?
Well, I think a little bit of both. I mean, definitely the switch to a 4-3, you know, is like in your face when you've got some of the players coming off of the edge. You know, Abdul mentioned Dwayne Harris. And then as you got later into the 90s, you know, you start recruiting players like Grant Wistrom, to you know, Chad Kelsey to do that kind of thing. And there were many others. And you know, you change the look of the linebacker group too when you adjust that scheme. I think that stuff, yeah, was very much in the public eye, and people talked about it a lot. In 91, you know, while it didn't have success at the end of the season, in comparison to what happened at the end of the season in 1990, when, as you guys mentioned, Nebraska loses at Oklahoma. And, you know, I can remember that game. Like I was young. I was in high school during that time, and I grew up in Omaha. And I remember that game that you talk about, and it was such a low point, not just because of the score, but, you know, Nebraska just like physically getting dominated. Remember Mickey Joseph getting hurt in that game along the sidelines, and then the Georgia Tech game after that. But in 91, which was Abdul's freshman year, Nebraska beat Oklahoma in Lincoln and, you know, went into the bowl game with a top 10, 11 ranking, and then got shut out by Miami. And I think you see, you saw then, much like you did in 90, like what great speed and athleticism could do on the defensive side. So Nebraska fans were fully on board with that kind of a transition defensively. Like I think there was a great amount of faith among fans that Osborne was going to figure things out with the offense. And it was like just a matter of time before they started doing things to get, it wasn't very long removed from, you know, a run of quarterbacks in the 80s, you know, whether it was Turner Gill or Steve Taylor, who were extremely athletic and doing great things with the option. So like, it was a matter of time before Nebraska got the right guy at quarterback. And that guy came in 92 to make the offense a national championship contender, but it had to happen on both sides of the ball. And Miami gave Nebraska the blueprint, undoubtedly. And you saw it on full display in that Orange Bowl at the end of the 91 season. And that's when Osborne, you know, there's a lot of conversation, a lot of memories, legend about him staying in Florida after that game and going to Bradenton and talking with Tommy and Tommy's mom and, you know, winning him over, so that he picked Nebraska. But like really what was going on with that team that was every bit as important was the transition on defense. And yeah, it was out there. I don't think the Unity Council and nutrition, were as much of it were big deals, but I don't think they were, I agree with you. Like that was more post-mortem. Like they were talked about when people went back in the mid-90s or late-90s and tried to, you know, put the pieces back together. That's when, you know, Jack Stark and some of the other figures like came to light.
I'm glad you went there, Mitch, just with the Tommy Frazier, cause that's where we're headed next. So some changes are being implemented. As you mentioned, Mitch, the 91 team, they go 9-2-1. They win the Big Eight, lose to a very good Washington team that I believe shared the national title, if I recall correctly. They tied with Colorado, and then lost that bowl game to Miami 22-0. And then the 92 team goes 9-3, also wins the Big Eight, loses to a top, I think Washington was number two at the time, loses to Iowa State 19-10. I still remember listening to that game on the radio. And drops mm-hmm. the Orange Bowl.
I was there. Yeah.
Were you?
Anyway. Yeah. Not in a working capacity. I was there as a fan in the stadium on that day at Jack Trice Stadium. Yeah.
Oof. That's good. The only team, Big Eight conference team we lost to our class.
That's
incredible. Of all the teams, Iowa State.
That's incredible. Yeah.
What was that? Todd Doxson, wasn't that? Was that the quarterback?
There was a lot of Marv. There was a lot of Omaha kids on that team.
Marv Seiler was the quarterback.
Marv Seiler.
Yeah.
Wow.
He's still running. He's still running. He needed to run a 400 that day. He'd still be running today to cross the finish line. But Nebraska couldn't catch him for whatever reason.
Yeah. So I don't know what happened that game.
So in 92, January of 93, the Huskers dropped the Orange Bowl to Florida State 27-14. Huskers seem to be making strides, still struggling with those athletic Florida teams. One major factor, as you mentioned, Mitch, is the arrival of a certain speedy quarterback from Bradenton, Florida, named Tommy Frazier, who was starting by the end of that 92 season. Abdul, that was your second year in the program. What do you remember about Frazier coming to Nebraska? Like, was it immediately apparent like what a difference maker he would become?
Definitely. Although he wasn't starting in practices, you can see that he was different, and not just athletically, but mentally. And, you know, he was doing things and saying things that young guys wasn't coming in the program, you know, talking like him, leading like him. And he was just mentally tough. A lot of people don't talk about that, but I just remember a play. It's freshman year, 92. We playing Florida State in a bowl game. And Jones, the All-American linebacker, what was his first name? But he was big time. He got drafted
really by Marvin Jones.
That's correct. And he hit Tommy pretty good and went to help Tommy up. Tommy get up and look him dead in the eye and tell him he going to have to do it all game. And I said, ooh, we ain't had nothing like that. It's different, yeah. I said, this is different. That's when I really knew that, yeah, this kid different. We're going to do some big things with this kid because he tough, and he not taking none of that because the Florida teams, it got worse. Every Florida team we played, the trash talk got worse every game. And Tommy, being from Florida, he was right in the mix of it. And I loved every bit of it.
Oh, that's so awesome. Mitch, do you have anything to add to that or anything surrounding Frazier, the recruitment and then those early, you know, that first year or two?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I didn't come on the scene in Lincoln and start reporting on the team until 93, his sophomore year. But I remember, and you know, I remember 92, you know, Tommy made his first start in late October that year at Missouri. And that's, you know, it wasn't like playing at Oklahoma or Colorado, but it was a relatively tough environment. And to send a true freshman out there and say, okay, this is now your deal. What he did was impressive. And I think at that time there was truly recognition in the program and around the outside of the program. And I was very much on the outside then, still being a high school kid, but I could tell in watching it that, okay, there's something different. Yeah. And I remember being at the game, you know, so as an 18-year-old, 17-year-old then, like I had friends who were in school a year older than me and had tickets. So I was at both of those games the next 2 weeks after the Missouri game, which was the Missouri game was Tommy's starting debut. And Nebraska played Colorado and Kansas in back-to-back weeks. And they were both top 15 opponents. Yeah. And the scores were 52-7 and 49-7. And it's like, all right, something is happening with the Nebraska program that is different from what I've seen as a kid growing up at any time going back to probably the early 80s. Like Frazier brought a different level of confidence among the entire team, even as a freshman to do that. And that is so rare. Like Nebraska has been dealing with some of that same stuff, you know, much, much different circumstances, but some of that same stuff here in the last 12 months where you ask a true freshman quarterback to lead and you can try to do it and you can know the right way to do it and you can be told and like guided along. But unless it's like in you and born into you, there's nothing that anybody on the outside can give an 18-year-old and make them go out and inspire 22 and 23-year-olds to play their butts off. Like you either have it or you don't. And he absolutely had it. And you know, then a week later they go to Iowa State and lose. But you know, that's a blip on the radar because the next week they blow the doors off OU in Norman and then went to Japan and beat Kansas State. And even that game that you referenced about Marvin Jones and Tommy in the Orange Bowl that year on New Year's Day against Florida State, like people expected that Nebraska was going to go to Miami that year and play Florida State and Bobby Bowden. And like it was going to be like the year before, 22-0 or, you know, 36-10 or whatever. And it was not like Nebraska was showing signs at that point of what the program was going to be over the next 5 years. And that's the last time that a Florida team got the best of Nebraska that January 1st of 93.
Yeah.
So Mitch, I don't want to get too far off track. I want to put you on record though. So you're saying that Dylan Raiola is the next Tommy Frazier and we're about to win 3 national titles in 4 years. Is that where we're going with this?
I feel like what I said was like you got that quality don't. And I mean, with Dylan, it's had to grow. And like, I think he has it in him, but very few people have it like at the surface ready to go when they're 18. Yeah. And Dylan went through growing pains last year, trying to bring that out. And I think we'll see, but like, I think that these last few months since the season ended, like he's come a long way in bringing it to the surface. Like it was at the surface with Tommy on day one. And that's so rare.
Yeah. Mitchell, I'm glad what you said there. I'm glad you brought it up about something just felt different about the Huskers. And we're going to talk about the 93 season here in a minute. But Abdul, I do have a question for you. Going into that after the 1992 season and then the 1993 season, the Huskers would turn a corner and start with an undefeated regular season in 93. Abdul, did it feel like something special was brewing with the Huskers at this point? Did something feel different? Mitch said it felt different for you as a player.
It did in practice. It got way tougher in practice, and it wasn't that. It wasn't from the drills we were doing. It was who was doing the drills. The kids you were going against changed. You know, it was a lot of speed, but more importantly, toughness. Like, I can't stress that enough. Like, the mental toughness of some of my teammates, like, to not, like, you had to will yourself in practice when it was ones against ones. It was one of those days like, yeah, I got to get some rest tonight. We got ones all day tomorrow. And so you had to be ready for those guys because it was no holds barred. Like we used to literally really try to cut block the starters. Like it was live. There's no green jerseys, no yellow jerseys. Everybody is live, including Tommy. And so we used to get after it after. Like, and you've seen that in practice. So in games, it was just like, man, it was just, I mean, the war was in practice starting that year. And I'm going to tell you when it really changed. In my class, a couple of us played in that game, that 92 Orange Bowl against Miami, and got shut out. And the three people that played, myself, Troy Dumas, and Dwayne Harris, all either won championships our senior years in high school, or we were in the championship. And playing against that team that nobody really talked about gave us a real glimpse of what national championship teams look like. Like that team was, you're talking about big, fast, strong, tough. It woke us up. Like, yeah, we got to be different. If we want to beat teams like that, we have to be different all the way around, and not just, you know, the guys who meant the most to the team, but everybody that was going to be on that field had to have a different personality and mental toughness. Because that's what them guys, the Shannon and Jesse Armstead, Michael Barrow, Derek Smith, man, it was, oh, man, and it was physical. We were known for being physical, but that year they out-physicaled us and was running all over the place.
Did you remember playing against The Rock in that game?
So The Rock didn't start playing until my senior year.
Okay. I see him on the roster, but yeah, he was a freshman.
Yeah, he didn't play. So you had guys like Rusty Medeiros. Like, these were like when Miami was running college football.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. We got to play against that and see that. It was so bad that some years ago, I decided to go look up the box score to see how many first downs we had. I think we had 6 first downs.
Oof.
That game. Yeah, 6. That's crazy.
Well, that's a good segue to 1993. The refuse to lose bunch. Undefeated regular season. Frazier's coming out party. Calvin Jones is all conference. Lawrence Phillips is a freshman. The itty bitty committee helps lead the way on offense. A guy by the name of Trev Alberts wins the Butkus Award and leads the defense. Huskers go into the Orange Bowl game against Florida State undefeated. But even though FSU is number 1 in the nation and Nebraska is number 2 going into the game, nobody was giving the Huskers much of a chance. Some betting line had Nebraska as a double-digit underdog.
Yeah.
The Big Red flat out outplays Florida State. FSU is aided by a phantom clipping call, a controversial goal line touchdown, and some other garbage calls. I just want to interrupt myself here for a minute. We often talk on this program about the college football industrial complex, which is the powers that be in college football constantly aligning against Nebraska and Nebraska's interests. There were some early signs of the college football industrial complex working against Nebraska in this game throughout the game. Huskers miss a last-second field goal to lose 18-16, but this one was different. Bobby Bowden would later say Nebraska won every aspect of the game but the scoreboard. Nebraska had caught up with the Florida schools. Abdul, what comes to mind when you think about that 1993 team?
I just remember just the feeling going into the game. So previously, the two previous bowl games I played in, kids always knew other kids on the team. Like, some of the Miami guys, some of our Texas guys knew, they played high school, some of them guys. And so they would be over to the hotel pre-bowl game, you know, back-to-back years it was like that. But in 93, we didn't allow none of that stuff. Like, if you have a friend on that Florida State team, they can't come to the hotel. Like, it was over for that. The friendly stuff, man, we at war, like, and people, we hate to use that terminology for football, but we really had that mentality. Like, is that stuff is over with. Like, they enemy. Like, we going at it. And so just that setting the stage, like, before we even get there, man, don't have none of them guys at the hotel. You want to see them, go somewhere and meet them somewhere else, they can't come to the hotel at all. And so, and we upheld that that year. And so going into that game, though, we thought we were going to beat them easy. You know, we watched the film, seen them. We knew what kind of team we had. We knew how we practiced. We knew how tough we were. And, you know, they didn't look tough on film, tough as we were, which we found out on the field. And so we really thought we were going to beat them that game, and we thought we were going to beat them handily.
Abdul, you just mentioned what kind of changed for you guys as a team and not fraternizing with the enemy. What do you remember about how Coach Osborne prepared you guys for that Orange Bowl game? Is there anything different? Did anything stand out about his approach for that particular game?
No, it was just business as usual. Like I said, more so, this is what people don't understand. For years and years and years, Coach Osborne, pretty much with a few twists and turns here and there, as far as play calls, we ran the same plays. Ran the same plays he was running in the 80s. You know what I mean? What changed is the personnel. You know, you had guys really believe. Like, people still ask me to this day, like you said, man, you was a high school all-state receiver in California, and you went to Nebraska. Like, people still ask me that. I'm 30 years removed from that. Why did you go to Nebraska, man? You could have been at Miami or one of them, because all of them teams recruited me. But I wanted to be a Husker. And so the mentality that we brought up, just wanting to play Nebraska style of football, it had finally came to fruition, because Coach Osborne, one of the most relaxed guys, low maintenance personnel coaches you could ever meet. But he always talked about being physical. Always. And that was always on our mind. Like, when teams played us, no matter the outcome, the score, make sure they know they played Nebraska. And we knew what he meant when he said that. Like, make sure they walk off that field feeling like, I don't want to play them dudes again, ever. Right? And so that's the mindset that we had going into it, and that's how we practiced. You know what I mean? Like, guys would get kicked out of practice sometimes because they had, like, slight injuries, and it got so physical that, you know, we would hold certain, hey, we got, because he don't understand. They told him, don't go all out hitting, but he's out here all out hitting. Just go take your stuff off, right? So we had situations like that because guys didn't know how to hold back.
Wow.
And that's out of practice as well.
I love it.
In
I
a bowl it. Game. So if you ever see highlights of bowl game practices, like, they show a clip almost every year I see when they start talking about the championships and they about to show one on one of the classic channels. But Tommy Frazier is running an option, man. He get high load. And I'm looking at it like, oh, he could have got hurt. Like, he could have got hurt before the game. Like, he don't have on no green jersey. And it's like, we in a full out scrimmage with the quarterback live. Be sure to announce the championship.
That's wild.
I guarantee you that don't happen anymore.
No. But hey, iron sharpens iron, baby. You guys get there to the game, Matt. And it's like you got a light day, right?
Right. Wow. Mitch, as somebody from the outside looking in and covering the Huskers, when it comes to that Florida State game, and TJ said it, like Bobby Bowden said, the Huskers won every aspect of that game except for the scoreboard. Do you think, like, what was the sense of what was going on there? Do you think the public and the media think T.O. had figured something out? Or was it more of a feeling that this was a huge missed opportunity that may not come again?
More the first option. Like, he had figured something out. I mean, if Frazier and, you know, Lawrence Phillips emerged that year, if those guys had been seniors, I think it would have felt different, but they were young players in the program, sophomore and freshman in the case of Lawrence Phillips. And you knew that they were coming back and could see what Nebraska was doing and, like, the momentum that it was building. And yeah, Trev Alberts was going away, but there were pieces around him. Like, there was no thought, oh, that the Nebraska was going to take a step back in 1994. I think the thing with me, and I look back at that 93 season, like, for whatever reason, I remember the Kansas game, just like, excruciating detail. Maybe because it was so unexpected. Like, it looked like for a good chunk of the second half of that game, like that was going to be, you know, a remake of the Iowa State game from the year before. But I think what differentiated the 93 team and what laid the foundation for the greatness in 94 and 95 is that they learned how to beat adversity and how to overcome the kind of situations that held them back maybe in the early part of the decade, the first 3 years of the decade. I mean, there were distractions off the field early in that season that probably paled in comparison to some of the distractions that happened like in the next 2 years. You know, the year after, not to get ahead of myself, but you know, Frazier gets hurt. And then the year after that, you have the situation with Lawrence Phillips. There were some minor things that happened, you know, maybe not minor, you know, in the eyes of the players, but there were things off the field that could have taken the team's attention away from football in 93. And they just plugged through it. I mean, they had the leadership to be able to keep their heads down and say, no, we're not going to let that derail us. And like, you saw adversity in that camp. I mean, Kansas had a two-point conversion away in Lawrence from beating Nebraska in November of that year. And it didn't happen. Nebraska got the stop and continued on undefeated. And I really felt like by the time they got to Miami, that it was a team of destiny, and like, people were greatly underestimating them. And maybe that was like me being naive as a college freshman, but like, that was the first time I'd ever been around. I say around, like, you know, I got to talk to those guys like a couple, three times a week and, you know, ask questions to Tom Osborne as a little freshman at the student newspaper. But, you know, I thought I knew, I didn't know what I was doing, but I thought I knew. And I thought like that was a team of destiny. And, you know, I was kind of, you know, I'm still like making that transition into the press box, and I was sitting in the stands. I was sitting in the second row of the upper deck at the Orange Bowl in the stands, for the game. Cause when at the Daily Nebraska, we got like two seats in the press box, and I was again a freshman. So I sat outside, and my dad took me and some buddies. You know, we were a little bit too young probably to go to Miami on our own. The next year we did, but a little too young to go to Miami on our own. So like, we had a chaperone, and that stadium was as electric and alive as any that I can remember on that night, January 1st for the Florida State game. And you know, Tommy he was playing against Charlie Ward. When you think about that, like, he was dueling Charlie Ward, like play for play for play. And
going to the gym can be discouraging, especially if you're putting in the work but barely seeing changes. But with Tonal, you can actually see your progress with every workout. Tonal provides the convenience of a full gym and the expertise of a personal trainer anytime at home with one sleek system. Designed to reduce your mental load, Tonal is the ultimate strength training system, helping you focus less on workout planning and more on getting results. No more second-guessing your technique. Tonal gives you real-time coaching cues to dial in your form and help you lift safely and effectively. After a quick assessment, Tonal sets the optimal weight for every move and adjusts in 1 pound increments as you get stronger, so you're always challenged. Tonal lets you choose from a variety of expert-led workouts, from strength to aero hit to yoga and mobility, to keep you coming back for more. For a limited time, go to Tonal.com to get $500 off your Tonal purchase, plus a free 4-year warranty. That's Tonal.com for $500 off, plus a free 4-year warranty. Tonal.com.
For all intents and purposes, he outdueled Charlie Ward, the Heisman Trophy winner in that game, as in Tommy was a sophomore. So what an incredible, one of the most incredible sporting events that I've ever attended. And, you know, it ended in heartbreak for Nebraska, but they walked off that field and, you know, I don't think there was a whole lot of doubt about where Nebraska was headed after that game.
Yeah.
Whew. Abdul, anything to add to that?
No, I just remember though, I don't know if you guys ever seen that movie, The Little Giants.
Oh, yeah.
And,
have I?
So, right. So that Kansas game, the only thing I really remember and can just picture vividly, after they missed the two, we know they kicking the onside. So it's all hands team, right? I'm on the hands team. And I remember going out there and lining up, right? And the kicker, is lined up directly towards me. He's kicking the ball to me. And I'm like, oh my goodness. I'm young, right? And I've never been nervous about anything football at all. But I did have some nerves going on. Like, if they get this, it's, yeah, I just remembered they break the huddle, he turned the T, and they looking right at me. That's it. So I know the feeling of an onside kick coming your way in a big game. But that was a tough – that Kansas team, Dana Stubblefield, man, they had some guys. They had some guys on that team. And that's why it was tough. The Big Eight defenses in the Big Eight were tough back then. Just tough, tough all around kids playing.
Yeah.
So wait, did the ball come to you?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And
I got it.
You took care of business. No problem. You knew you had it all along.
Yeah, I did.
was that after the failed 2-point conversion? That was after. Yeah.
They was trying to get it back. They were tough. That was a tough. They had two good running backs, June Henley. I forget the other one name, but yeah, two top QB. Yeah, that was a good team. That was a good team.
KU was pretty good back then. Those early 90s. Yeah. He was Glenn Mason was their coach, and I remember them being pretty salty. They were usually top 20, and
That was the year, too. That like the year prior. They had knocked Derrick Brown out when Calvin Jones, came and started the Weebacks. I remember Kwame Lassiter ended up playing, I think, for the Arizona Cardinals. But, man, he put a lick on him.
Well, let's pivot to that 1994 season. I feel like we could probably do, like, two or three whole episodes just on that season. And it's pretty, you know, as Matt mentioned, we were at like the perfect age for your favorite college football team to be awesome. And we were 12 in 94 when the Huskers won their first national title. So you think you remember everything, but in just going back and looking through and reading Henry's book and looking through the specifics of that season, so much happened. So, and first of all, one thing I had forgotten was the debut of Husker Vision and the debut of the tunnel walk as we know it today, which I just remember, again, being in the stadium, thinking that was like nothing on earth could ever top that experience, just thinking it was the coolest thing ever. But then, so you look through the season, the Huskers start, 4-0. They're in the kickoff classic against West Virginia. Beat Texas Tech, beat UCLA pretty handily, dismantled Pacific, but it's before that Pacific game that Frazier starts feeling pain in his leg. And after the Huskers get up to about a 14-0 lead, they get him out of the game and just, you know, it's Pacific, right? But the next day is when the blood clot is discovered. So that, as we all know, will be a recurring theme for the rest of the season. It will keep Frazier out for the remainder of the regular season. So up to that point, little used and little talked about backup Brooke Behringer comes in to start. His first game is at Wyoming. And in his first game as a starter, he gets a collapsed lung. And so that, again, is an ongoing theme that would continue to resurface. Behringer would still be able to start the majority of the games that year. He would go 7-0 as a starter. But there's also the dynamic with that one is it would keep him out from starting the Kansas State game. And then you get Matt Turman, the Terminator game. And it was so funny to read about that and just talk about, like, basically just we're going to hand it off to Lawrence Phillips 45 times.
I was going to say, that was the Lawrence Phillips game.
Right. And the Huskers grind through a 17-6 win over Kansas State. And so there's so many storylines to this. And then you get to the bowl game, and I don't want to get there quite yet, but you get to the bowl game and Frazier's suddenly healthy and able to play again. Behringer's healthy and also has sort of taken over and led the team for the entire regular season. And you've got a quarterback controversy going into one of the biggest games in Nebraska football history. So before we get to that, Abdul, I'd love to know, just like, if you have
a favorite memory or favorite memories or reflection on that sort of 1994 regular season with everything that happened?
I remember the Wyoming game. They came into Lincoln, and I just remember like it feeling like Iowa State when that game started. They were up, and they were winning most of the game. And mid-third, we started taking control of that game. But Wyoming that came into Lincoln, they were like a – and they were kind of like an Iowa State team. They had a couple kids from Nebraska on the team. And I just remember it being real tough, physical. That hit that Brooke took, that punch in his lung, that was a brutal hit, you know, trying to get in the end zone. And guy put a nice hit on him. But I remember that game because it was tough and it was unexpected. Like, we were expecting to really, because we didn't, by that time, we didn't have bad practices. Like, we got after each other. Every day we practiced, it was tough. And so we didn't have bad practices. We didn't have guys sitting out of practices. You know, prima donna guys, I'm the big dude here, I don't have to practice. We didn't have all that stuff. That stuff was gone from the program. And so when Wyoming came in, it kind of, you know, woke us up a little bit. It was a wake-up game because that game was too close. And we started putting some hits on them. You know, I don't know if y'all remember the Troy Dumas sack, quarterback's face mask got bent up. And then when he set up, face mask was pointing up in the air, you know, from his from the helmet. And so that game, we had to step it up. And that game kind of woke us up during the season to where we had to, you know, get back to that grind of just dominating and not taking nobody lightly.
So Wyoming in that game got up 14-0.
Yes. Yeah.
And
Lincoln.
That's what I remember, because the whole state was shell-shocked from what had happened during the week. And I mean, we went as media and, you know, taking the fans along for the ride. We went from covering practices and talking to Coach Osborne in the corner of Memorial Stadium on a Tuesday night to standing outside the hospital on 48th Street waiting for, you know, Tommy to come out to his girlfriend's car, or, you know, the doctor was holding press conferences. I mean, to say that people's attention was divided and that people were distracted is a gross understatement. There was very, very little talk that week about Wyoming. It was all about really? Tommy and his leg and when can he come back. And I can't imagine, but what it was like inside the team. Like, they're trying, you know, to stay focused, whatever. But, you know, you want to know what's going on with Tommy, of course. So it's 14-0 after, and then it was 21-7 Wyoming in the, you know, late in the second quarter of that game. So Nebraska came around, and, you know, Brooke got it together, and they started going to Brooke. He ran for 3 touchdowns in the second and third quarter of that game. I think Wyoming kind of expected, and they put some hits on him. They kind of expected, oh, Nebraska's going to have to become this drop back passing team without Tommy. And that obviously was not the case. And the quarterback, the backup QB, was a pretty good runner, pretty good athlete too. So they got it together, but like the defense, I think, took that as a real wake up call and like an insulting kind of situation. Like, Wyoming came into Memorial Stadium and put up 32 points against the Blackshirts. So the next four games, Nebraska allowed 3, 6, 7, and 7.
Wake up call.
Never again.
One other thing, I know Jeff's got a question. One other thing, I mean, there's so many high points that jump out that season, but a huge one to me was a 24-7 win over Colorado in Lincoln. And they in with Cordell Stewart. They had beaten Michigan in a classic game with the end of game Hail Mary earlier in the season. And that was another one where I think there were a lot of question marks about, you know, can Nebraska win this kind of big game? Will they beat Colorado? And my recollection of that game is that the Huskers just manhandled them from start to finish.
Yeah, yeah, they were Nebraska was an underdog at home, and it was Brooks like going
versus
to
the three or something like that.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah. Brooke just Osborne just completely outcoached McCartney and their defense in that game, like by using the tight ends. I don't know, was it Eric Alford? I think it off the top of my head. Yeah,
Eric Alford and Matt Schaub. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, it was that was the most talented team outside of maybe those Miami and Florida State teams that Nebraska played in that era. And that Colorado team probably gave them a run. But like Stewart, Rashawn Salaam, the running back, and Michael Westbrook, like those guys took a backseat to nobody in terms of the talent that Nebraska saw in that era of football.
Yeah. If you talk to guys on that defense, they, you know, other than Lawrence Phillips, who they used to see in practice, you know, every day, they would tell everybody that Rashawn Salaam was that other guy that was hard to deal with on the football field, because they said he ran tough and violent. And so that Colorado team, though, I'm with you, Mitch. I think they could have won the championship too.
Mm-hmm.
That team could have won the national championship also. You know, had they come into Lincoln and got past us, yeah, I think they could have ended up beating Miami as well. That was a tough, well-rounded football team. But like Mitch said, that was one of the first times we brought out a couple plays we had been practicing for years. Like Coach Osborne used to have plays we would practice that. 91, 92, we didn't even run them. 93, we got to run some of them. But that 94 year, that wham. So we had a play. It was an option wham play to where Cluster would come in motion and hit the nose guard, who was All-American, Hicks. Like, he had to start doing different things with that. That was a tough kid. And he learned from 91, 92, having to deal with Edmund from Washington, who dominated us, you know, for back-to-back years. And so he had this play waiting for this game, and we probably ran it about 3-4 times. But, man, Cluster whammed him all three times, and so he got slower and slower as the game went on. He's looking for that motion wham, right? But that was just classic Coach Osborne in his coaching bag. Like Mitch said, just out-coached him bad that game.
CU was 0 for 11 on third downs in that game. The coaching mismatch, I think, went both ways. Like Charlie and his defense, to think that you could hold that Cordell Stewart team 0 for 11 on third downs and 0 for 4 on fourth downs. So 0 for 15
Nobody did that year. And they might have had the toughest schedule that year.
That's crazy.
Texas, Michigan. Notre Dame in the bowl. That year, that schedule they had was brutal, and they beat everybody but us. Another thing that happened that game, in games like that, Coach Osborne would kind of turn over the pregame talk, and it was McBride who, oh, man, we jacked. Like, I don't even know if he got through the speech. You know, guys were ready to come out the tunnel. You know, as he's still talking, like, oh, my goodness. It was just that atmosphere was crazy, because they turned on a video of McCartney, the coach, head coach, talking real disrespectful about Nebraska. It was like somebody found a video of him talking crazy about Nebraska, and he didn't know he was being videoed. And they put that on pregame in our meeting. And then McBride come right after that. And, oh, my goodness. They didn't have a chance. they didn't have a chance that game.
That's awesome.
Oh, my God.
That's awesome. I do have a question. I want to go back to this quarterback controversy thing. I always find this sort of stuff fascinating, how decisions are made and the choices that – or the thought and how that choice is made in the end. Abdul, let's jump forward to that Miami game. Tommy was eventually picked to start that bowl game. And I'm just curious, like, you know, Brooke led the team for a good chunk of that season. What was the impact on the team for that decision? Or what was your overall, response to that? How did you feel about it?
I just remember one thing about Coach Osborne during that time when, and this happened in 91, when they finally started letting freshmen like myself play early. They were not doing that at Nebraska before 91. If guys came in that could play, we had four in our class. Every year after 91, you had freshmen playing, starting at the University of Nebraska. And so the fairness of everything became to the forefront. And so when Coach told the whole team that, you know, the starter is going to be predicated on who practices the best during the bowl games. And we all knew, you know, the system we ran and what kind of plays, you know, we were running and getting ready for Miami with that, it was probably going to be Tommy because he just fit that offense, you know, all the way around. And if it's a competition, and that wasn't too many quarterbacks, I don't care. We was throwing team. He, Tommy Frazier in competition was going to find a way to be the man. And that's what happened down in at the Orange Bowl that, you know, when they said it was going to be a quarterback competition, we kind of knew, you know, Tommy's going to start the game. Mm-hmm. Hey, he's going to start this game.
Well, and the way it played out was pretty cool, too, because you guys got down 10-0, and then Brooke comes in and throws a touchdown pass to keep the team in the game.
Yeah.
And then, so it's 10-7, then Huskers get down 17-7 again, and then Tommy comes in and leads, you know, the last two drives to close the deal. So they really both, I mean, they both had a hand in the team's success in the regular season, yeah, and they both had a hand in closing the deal and bringing the national championship to Nebraska. I always thought that was really cool the way that played out.
It was, and I think that happening like that was a big reason on why that game went like that and why we won in the end, and why it ended with Tommy, a true competitor who sat and watched a quarter and a half being on the bench and just waiting for that next opportunity. And it came to him against, and you got to remember these Miami teams, these Florida teams rather, they didn't recruit Tommy. And so when we got ready to play them, man, he really ready. Right. So he always wanted to show them what they were missing and not recruiting them. And that's why he always had really good games against them Florida teams and really performed. But to bring in Brooke in, all of a sudden what Tommy was doing early, you know, it's hard to game plan for that stuff because I just remember them always talking about they had a quarterback emulating Tommy Frazier. You don't hear about a quarterback emulating Brooke, right? That's why Brooke come in and we right down the field. It should have been twice. We fumbled on one, but it should have been back-to-back touchdowns. And so I don't think they were ready for that. But then, you know, they had a really good coaching staff with Erickson, those guys, and so guys that can coach. And so they kind of adjusted to that, put Big Brooke off, which brought Tommy back in the game to finish the game.
Yeah, what's amazing about that story with Tommy and not being recruited by Miami, I mean, that kind of, to me, that kind of is reminiscent of like the way that somebody like Michael Jordan would look for motivation in his mm-hmm. career, like always yep. feeling like he got slighted. I mean, if you want to take a step back, like, and look at that objectively, like there's a reason why Miami didn't recruit Tommy Frazier. Like, I mean, he didn't fit the type of quarterback that Miami showcased in that era. I mean, Frank Costa was the QB on that team. They had Gino Toretta, and you guys know the list. I'm sure there was that Tommy could have found a way to contribute to Miami's great teams, but it would have required like some kind of a change for him or for their offense. Like he wasn't a pocket passer in that way. Yeah. So like it makes sense that Miami didn't take him, even though he was in their backyard. But the fact that he was able to find motivation from that and, you know, bring that into this game like several years later. I mean, you got the likes of Ray Lewis and Warren Sapp, you know, out there on that defense. And there's all, of course, the stories about Tommy talking to Warren Sapp when he came back in. And it's incredible, like legendary type of stuff. But yeah, that game, there's so many things about that game, from Osborne's speech to the team in the locker room at halftime and telling them how the second half was going to go, that, you know, it's absolutely, I mean, it's maybe the most memorable game. And you put it up there with the game of the century in 1971 as the most memorable in Nebraska football history.
Yeah, that was where I was going to go next, Mitch, was, you know, I've probably watched that Orange Bowl more than any Husker game. I mean, I've probably seen it 50 times. I've got, you know, the legendary Kent Pavelka's, you know, so he's got several awesome radio calls that I had memorized as a kid. But one of the things that I remember specifically about it was Coach Osborne, and I think it was at halftime, and maybe you can correct me, Abdul, but I remember him saying, you know, that the game was really chippy, right? And there's a lot of trash talk, as you mentioned earlier, Abdul, but I remember him saying, keep your hands down. Keep your hands down. There's going to be a big penalty at some point in this game. It's going to affect the game. Could you maybe add a little bit, some to that, or just a little, your from your perspective, Coach Osborne kind of coming out like a prophet at the end of this thing?
So I'll take you back to coming in as a freshman with the guys I came in with. We were, you know, doing the testing, the freshman testing, the 40s, the 10s, the 300-yard shuttle. And I remember us all sitting down and Dwayne Harris, you know, getting up, and he just, you know, started talking. And then he said, man, we're going to leave here with two. He did just like this. He flipped his fingers up and said, we're going to leave here with two championships. We hadn't even had a practice yet, right? that was just a testing day. So fast forward to the 94 season and the 95 bowl game. The penalty happens. It's Christian Peters, class of 91. The one that the grizzly bear, like he ready to fight anybody for touching him. What are you looking at? Just looking at him wrong. They get the flag on Christian Peters, keep his hands down. The guy mauls him on the ground, get the 15-yard penalty. A few plays later, they backed up. Dwayne Harris gets the sack safety. And if you go back and look, I get chills thinking about this. It was the same thing he did when he said, we leaving with two. He got Costa's jersey in one hand and flipped the two in the other. And when I seen it, as I went back like you and watched the game and seen that, man, that's one of my favorite plays of all time. Because it was the exact thing he did when he said, we leaving with two. You got Costa in one hand, safety with the flip two. And I said, man, that is crazy that it happened like that in that game.
Do you think T.O.'s speech at halftime resonated with Christian and helped him keep his hands down and not hit back? Basically,
there was almost about four fights in that game on special teams alone. So that play, without Coach Osborne saying anything, and that might have been the play that broke the fight out, the real fight. Because what he was doing to Christian on the ground, and Christian, the Christian that didn't hear that speech would have probably went off. But that speech and some of the speeches that Coach Osborne gave us for years, I always told people, now that I'm older and you watch the games, you watch the Super Bowls and all these big games, they come out with these lines, these betting lines. I've always said if Coach Osborne was a betting man, he would be a multimillionaire. He can tell you how games were going to go all the time. In 95, when I started coaching, I used to ask him about games, and he would say how games were going to go. And you like, what the? Like, how do we know this game is going to go like this? you turn the game on and it's like when he told us we gonna score against Colorado on the first play. Man, and then we go 70 yards of Mon Green down the sideline. First drink, everybody freaking out on the sideline. Like, man, who is this coach? Who is this dude, man? Like, this dude just told us how the bowl game was going to go. Then come on the back end and tell us about this first play, and it happened. I remember telling my dad, he still talks about that play. He still can't believe we was scored on the first play after I told him Coach Osborne said he's scoring on the first play of the game. And this was a top 10 Colorado team.
Yeah. It goes back to T.O. being somewhat of an offensive savant. I mean,
genius.
The Orange Bowl and just setting up the whole game, and then hits him with fullback trap twice. And it works because he had taken the whole game and set that thing up. And that's what we always did. Yeah.
So
crossing the plane, rubbing salt in the wound.
Yeah. What happened was them guys had to overplay that option.
Oh no.
We lost.
Let me jump in and just say that the main takeaway that I have from 94 and like what Abdul was just saying about Osborne and I know this podcast series is about Osborne, but like that stuff, it only works because of the types of players. Like, and I don't mean athletically, but like the minds on the players that he brought in to be leaders on that team. And that was a great example that he told about Christian Peter and like not losing his cool in that moment in the Orange Bowl. But I think back in that 94 season, and are you guys familiar with the story about Rob Zadiska and the Colorado game? Like, we talked a bunch about the Colorado game, but before that game, you guys hear me all right?
I can hear you. It's kind of an echo.
Yeah.
There you go. We got Abdul back. All right, go ahead.
Okay. So I'm just commenting on the leadership that team had and how like it all doesn't come together. You know, no matter how much of a genius Osborne is, like it doesn't come together unless you have the right mix of leaders. And so Rob, as a linchpin in the pipeline, was a master motivator himself. And there's a great story that's totally a true story about how Zadiska told all of the other guys on the offensive line on the night before the Colorado game in 94 that he watched the news on TV and saw Darius Holland and Shannon Clavel, two of Colorado's defensive linemen, get off the plane carrying pipe cutters and like talking to the camera about how they were going to disassemble the pipeline. And this was not in any way true. Like, he completely made it up. Like, there was nothing remotely like this that happened. And he told all of those guys that this, and they got so pissed off. And like went out and played harder and did, you know, played past the whistle, whatever. It's not why they won the game. It's not why Colorado obviously went 0-for-15 on third and fourth down in that game. But like, you needed all of these other pieces around Coach Osborne to make it work. He could be the smartest coach in the world and predict things, but if you didn't have guys like Rob Zadiska backing him up and finding ways to push the buttons of their teammates, like that stuff never happens.
Wow.
Pretty special group. We'll end here. Abdul, we will bring it back to T.O. And would love to just hear your thoughts on pretty much to a person, at least everyone we've talked to on this show and everything I've read about is that former players revere Coach Osborne and hold him in a very high regard. We'd just be curious what it meant to you and your teammates to bring home that national championship, help him finally win the big one, get to the mountaintop, and kick off what is still one of the greatest college football dynasties in history.
It kind of meant the world to us, you know, especially when you look at recruiting. You know, a lot of people don't know, you know, you get your position coaches that come in and recruit you, but you also, that head coach is the final decision maker. And so I know I still have the picture in my living room with myself, Coach Osborne, and my best friend, who was a Husker fan, who wanted to play in Nebraska, ended up playing at Arizona, though. He's a part of that Desert Swarm defense they had down there, which Coach Osborne and coaches watched how they dismantled Miami. People forget, I think it was the 92 season, Miami played Arizona, and it was like the first time during those years that somebody had did Miami like that defensively. Coaches went down and watched that, and that 4-3 and all that, you know, that's how it came about, the speed. Smaller guys at linebacker that can move and fly, but powerful in the weight room. And so getting back to Coach Osborne, that man is special to a lot of us because not only because of his coaching vernacular, but because he really believed in us all. And he would tell you stuff to make sure you knew you was important. Like, he was a psychologist. Like, I used to be kind of enamored with some of the stuff he used to say and do. I just remember being down after a game, having to sit on the sideline, a UCLA game, my senior year, not start. And then he coming back to Pacific game. And Coach Brown said, Coach Osborne has never did that in his life. He called a play, gave it to me to take in. 91, I'll never forget. I write 91, pass play. And he said, tell him to throw you the ball. We never said tell somebody, throw somebody the ball. And I catch the pass and score, right? And I'm like, man, this dude. And Coach Brown told me later, he knew that he was going to need you to win the championship. And so he had to get your mind back right. And I was like, man, this dude a genius. this dude a genius, man. That I've never been around. I've been around coaching since, and I've never been around anybody like him in coaching. Not even close.
Beautiful.
Incredible. Fantastic conversation, gentlemen. Abdul Muhammad, Mitch Sherman, it's truly an honor to have you both join us for this episode. We greatly appreciate it. Any final thoughts from either of you guys?
Go Big Red. And I'm with Mitch. Yeah. And I'm with Mitch. I think Rayola gonna be the guy.
Yeah.
I watched him all spring, and I seen something. I seen something that I've seen before. He might be that guy.
I hope you're right.
Oh yes.
I can't top that. Thanks for having me on. It's always fun to go back and talk about that time. It was such a huge, huge, like, formative, important time for me. I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now and have done for the last 30 years if it wasn't for those years in the early and mid 90s.
So cool. We appreciate you both spending so much time with us. Hang with us, common fans.
Go ahead, man. I just wanted to say something to Abdul. You know, we didn't have Husker season tickets, you know, so I'd get to maybe a couple games a year. We did have Husker basketball tickets, though, and I watched Husker basketball. But one of my main reasons to go to Husker basketball games is because guys like Abdul and some of the other football players would be there. And so I knew that if I could go find them, they usually sit in the old bleachers in Section A at Devaney, and they would be down there. And Abdul, you and some of your teammates were so cool to us little kids that just wanted to come up and meet you and get your autograph. And I got your autograph on the hat that T.O. used to wear, the cursive Huskers, the red with the black bill. And you signed it right under the bill. For years and years and years, I rubbed that bill like this, whenever the Huskers needed a play, man. And more often than not, they'd come up with that play. So I want to thank you
for providing
me with my lucky Husker charm. And hopefully, eventually, when I put that thing back on, now maybe it starts working again.
This year.
So thank you for being so cool to us kids. You guys were our heroes, man. So yeah, this has been really cool.
You totally were. As we said, like, 12, 13, and 15 when we won those national titles, and like nothing was more important at those ages than our college football team. So
yeah,
Matt, I'd love to know what the hell you've been doing with that hat for the last 10 years. Cause we could,
I got to
really
put it back on. I got it. I have it. It's upstairs in my house right now.
Nice. We'll start wearing it this year again.
You got it.
Thanks again to Mitch Sherman, Abdul Muhammad. Yeah. Fantastic conversation.
Thank you.
Stick around for the next episode of the TO series. We're going to wrap up the 90s with Tom Chattel and Grant Wistrom. That'll be a great episode as well. Thanks for hanging with us, as always, Common fans. In the meantime, as always, GBR for life.
That's right.
Breaking news coming in from Bet365, and it's no surprise. Same game parlay from Bet365 just keeps getting better.
Well, it's even easier to make a bet. Choose from the most popular markets, like hits, run line, totals, and home runs. So many to choose from.
Download the app, start building your bet, and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Breaking news, and this one is almost unbelievable.
Yeah, it's all about new customers at Bet365, because they get $150 in bonus bets when they bet $5, win or lose. And even better, bonus bets can be used on the spread, totals, and player props.
There you have it. Bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. And see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. T&Cs apply. Available in app only.